You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hi, I'm your inner dream monologue. And you're fast asleep, so I'll be quick. Great job using the Colgate Optic White Overnight Teeth Whitening Pen before bed. When used as directed, it gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 7 days. So while I fly and talk to animals, you're removing teeth stains with ease. Sweet dreams. And when you wake up, keep on living life to the brightest. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Billboard Pop Shop Podcast. I'm Keith Caulfield, Senior Director of Charts at Billboard.
And I'm Katie Atkinson, Billboard's Deputy Editor Digital.
Hello, Katie.
Hey, Keith.
Happy post-Grammy week.
Yeah, and pre-Super Bowl and pre-Oscars, because the fun never stops.
There's always something, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And as always, the Billboard Pop Shop Podcast is your one-stop shop for all things pop on Billboard's weekly charts. In addition, you can always count on a lively discussion about the latest pop news, fun chart stats and stories, new music, and guest interviews with music stars and folks from the world of pop.
Today on the show, we are going to recap the big news from the 2020 Grammy Awards, and we've got big chart news about Eminem. Plus, what a coincidence, we've got an interview with 17-time Grammy Award winner Sting on the show this week.
17.
Share the wealth, man. He joins us to talk about his starring role in the touring production of his musical, The Last Ship, his upcoming Las Vegas residency, and much more. So stay tuned for that in just a bit.
But first, before we get started, if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast provider so you won't miss an episode. And if you want to explore more podcasts from Billboard, visit billboard.com/podcasts.
All right, let's get into the big chart news of the week. And it's actually the biggest chart news on both the Billboard 200 Albums chart and the Billboard Hot 100 Songs chart. And that's from Eminem. He debuts straight in at number one on the Billboard 200 with his new album, Music to be Murdered By.
Sounds like a light listen.
Just a happy, just an album full of happy little ditties. And that was, by the way, surprise released on January 17th, like his last album was surprise released. Surprises.
Who needs promo?
Eminem certainly doesn't. And over on the Hot 100 chart, the album's song Godzilla, which features Juice WRLD, the late Juice WRLD, debuts at number three. Now, the album starts with 279,000 equivalent album units earned in the week ending January 23rd, according to Nielsen Music, MRC data. And that earns Eminem his record-extending 10th debut at number one and a 10th number one album in a row. All 10 of his number ones, say that again, All of his albums have hit number one except for his very first album, the Slim Shady LP. Well, at least his first album to chart, that
yes.
is. So, nice track record.
I think that's his first major label release.
Too. That's, I think, the way that we should probably frame it, yeah. over on the Hot 100, Godzilla debuts at number three, and it marks the 22nd top 10 for Eminem and the third for the late Juice WRLD.
It's just Eminem's world, and we're living in it.
Yep.
So let's talk a little bit about the Grammy Awards, especially considering our very fitting pre-Grammy podcast guests last week. Should we maybe just rename these things the Eilish Awards at this point?
Sure.
So Billie performed on the show. She won 5 awards in total out of her 6 nominations, and she won all of the top 4 categories. Hey. Listeners of the show know that those are Album of the Year for When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go?, Record of the Year and Song of the Year, both for Bad Guy, and Best New Artist. And she's just the second artist to ever achieve this feat after Christopher Cross did it in 1981 and the first woman to ever do it.
And the youngest person and, you know,
it's
obviously
a whole mess. Yeah, youngest to win Album of the Year as well.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
She beat Taylor because Taylor had the record, yeah. Right? Taylor mm-hmm. Swift with yeah. Fearless when she was a little bit older, I guess.
Yeah, well, Billie was nominated at 17 and won it at 18. So.
Wow.
Obviously, it was a huge night. And, you know, as I mentioned, we had Phineas. Keith had a great chat with Phineas last week on the podcast.
Older brother who produced the album.
And he was nominated for 5 awards for the night, given that not all of the awards go to producer of the album, as he was. And he actually won producer of the year, non-classical, and best engineered album, also for When We All Fall Asleep. So he won all 5 of his prizes. Like,
nice track record.
What?
And hey, we look brilliant for having him on the show.
Yeah, we always book the winningest guest. I mean, actually, this is our 2nd year in a row of having the album of the year winner on.
Oh,
because
you're right.
We had Casey Musgraves last year.
Oh, wow.
That's like a lot of pressure.
Hey, so.
Or it's also a lot of like clout.
Publicists, artists, if you're listening.
This is how you secure this thing.
This is how you win Album of the Year. You get booked on the Billboard Pop Shop podcast after the voting has already closed.
Yeah, right. I was going to say, or is it because these people are the best at playing this whole game and they book everything?
Who knows?
But anyway, congratulations to Billy and to Phineas for your massive night.
Yeah, so should we talk a little bit more or should we just move on? maybe we can just move on. Should we move on?
I mean, we could just say that I was backstage and you were on the Billboard live stream.
I was on a live
the
stream.
Red carpet show. And, you know, it's always a crazy time, but a fun time.
Yeah, make sure to visit Billboard.com for
all of the Grammy coverage.
All of the Grammy coverage that Katie Atkinson wrote.
Yeah, all of it.
All of it. Okay, so now it's time for our interview with Sting, the 17-time Grammy Award winner, Emmy winner, 4-time Oscar nominee, and Tony Award nominee. Phew. Joins us to talk about how he's having the greatest adventure of his life, starring in the musical stage show The Last Ship, which is touring the U.S. through April. Now, The Last Ship is a personal story and a personal show from Sting. It's based upon basically his childhood and his youth, growing up sort of in the shadow of a shipyard in England. And that shipyard was basically falling on hard times as the shipbuilding industry waned back in the day. So it comes from a personal place for him, and it's very important to him to take the show on the road. And obviously, it's also a treat for us to get to see Sting in it. So that's touring in the U.S. through April, so go check it out. And plus, we chat about his upcoming Las Vegas residency. And of course, I make a song request because I am want to do that. A new dance theater production set to his music that is about to premiere in London. And his thoughts on the passing of Juice WRLD, who sampled Sting's Shape of My Heart in his smash hit Lucid Dreams. And why Sting, unlike certain other artists who shall go unnamed, has been open to the idea of other artists interpolating his work. So, take a listen to our interview with Sting.
On the earth or in heaven or under the sun, when the last ship sails.
Welcome back to the Billboard Pop Shop podcast, Sting. How are you?
I'm very happy to be talking to you on this podcast.
Thank you. You're currently starring in the touring production of your Tony Award-nominated musical, The Last Ship, which will be visiting cities in the U.S. through April, I believe. Now, you were not part of the original Broadway production, but you joined it towards the tail end. And then ever since then, I think when it's been staged, I think for the most part, you have been in the show. Yeah. I mean, this is not the first time you've been in the show. You've been in the show elsewhere.
I've actually done 115 performances so far.
No one's counting, but...
I know that because I looked it up. but I never intended to be in this play. You know, I wrote it for actors other than myself.
Well, you're an actor too, though.
Oh, well. Yeah. You know, I get by. But it's odd that once I was asked to be in it, because quite frankly, a name will sell more tickets than someone who isn't the name.
This happens all the time.
It's just a commercial reality. So I agreed to do it. And then that worked. We started to sell tickets. And then once I'd got my feet wet, I realized that I was enjoying it and could bring even more of myself into this character, which I'd created myself. So I've had a great time, and whenever the opportunity to play the role comes up, now I grab it with both hands because it's so much fun.
Why was it important to take the show on the road? Because not all shows that were on Broadway necessarily always transfer to a touring production, and sometimes it just don't work. But it feels like, I mean, obviously people need to know that this is a very personal story and it comes from your childhood. But aside from that, I mean, you could have just said, well, you know, that was good. We had our time. But you're like, no, let's take this thing on the road.
You know, for me, the play is never finished. It's always in the process of being remade, night by night, performance by performance, week by week, season by season. You're always looking to improve it, to hone it, to, you know, make it better than it was. And we're still in that process. And I love that. The fact that it's not a museum artifact, it's actually a living, breathing, organic thing with real actors, and you're playing off them all the time. It's a bit like jazz, you know. You know the general shape of the tune you're playing, but within that, there's all kinds of variations can come happen and surprise you and surprise the audience. So the opportunity to bring it to the people, which someone suggested, you know, first of all, we're here in LA, then we're going to be in DC, San Francisco, Detroit, which I'm looking forward to immensely, and Minneapolis, St. Paul. It tells the audience that it's really for them, and it's not necessarily a tourist attraction. Yeah. You know, it's about a real issue. It's a love story set in an industrial town that's falling apart. But that's not the subject of the thing, really. It's a love story.
Right.
And it's an entertaining one.
When you said Detroit, I'm like, I think if the cities on the tour, I feel like Detroit might appreciate it a little bit more, considering I think there's a direct sort of connection between sort of the auto industry and the shipbuilding industry in many
ways.
You're
right.
Certainly here in America.
But I was a little apprehensive about LA. Would they get it? And having done a week here, they certainly do.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's industry specific. Right. I think there's an anxiety in the world generally that this play addresses. How do you deal with anxiety as a community in the world? And all of us are suffering that.
Did anyone, I'm wondering, you know, because people that are going to see the show need to know that it's not like a jukebox musical. It's not just like, and here's the hits of Sting, you know, in a shipyard. There are a couple moments where you hear a couple Sting familiar favorites, but don't go into it expecting that. I'm wondering, when you were sort of in the initial stages of putting the show together, did anyone float the idea, you know, it would be a great idea if this show was just set to your hits?
A jukebox musical.
With the same story, but a jukebox musical with all of your songs. Like, wouldn't that get more people to come?
Then you'd have to shoehorn the songs into some spurious plot that would be stupid. And I had no desire to do that. I wanted to do the most difficult thing in the theater, which is to create an original musical. That's the hardest thing you can do, and anybody will tell you that. But I've never been one to want to fall off the bottom rung of any ladder. You know, I'm pretty mm-hmm. ambitious. And it's 9 years in. I've had the greatest adventure, and I'm having the greatest adventure of my creative life. It's so satisfying.
So did anyone actually ever suggest that?
Yeah, people have suggested it all the time and presented me with a really dumb, you know, plot ideas.
Suddenly it's Mamma Mia in a shipyard. No offense to Mamma Mia, which is lovely. I'm curious to sort of segue here. There's another theater production that is about to start up for you that you are not starring in, but that would also be kind of fun to see you in this. It's premiering in London on February 6th, and it's called Message in a Bottle. It's a dance theater production choreographed by Kate Prince, who also choreographed the hit musical Everybody's Talking About Jamie, which is brilliant. You should see it.
Yeah.
I saw it. It's great. They're kind of vague with the storyline of this, probably on purpose, but how were you pitched this, and was it an immediate yes for you?
Well, it's being performed at Sadler's Wells, which is one of the most famous dance companies in Britain, very historic. And for me, dance is a very abstract art form. So they're using my music to create a story, but in a much more abstract way than it would be if there was dialogue and, you know, like a play.
Right.
And so I was intrigued by that because it's not an area I know very much about. And really, they've been given carte blanche to do whatever they want with my music.
Here's my catalog. Do what you want.
There it
effectively.
Is. I saw an early workshop and was very touched by it, very moved by it. How the movements were telling me a story, directed by my songs. But it was interesting.
The description of the show is a bit cryptic. It says it's described as a vital and uplifting story of humanity and hope. And it's apparently set in a village alive with joyous celebrations. that is suddenly under siege and everything changes forever. I think there's something in there speaking to perhaps immigrants or immigration. I could be wrong. I guess when we see it, we'll know.
Well, in the workshop I saw, that seemed to be the meta,
overall
the meta, you know, reality that they were.
It's also
operating
dance, in. So sometimes it's not as.
It's also very topical.
Yeah,
you know, the refugee crisis is with us and will not go away while there are still wars being prosecuted, while we still have climate change issues, and so this is probably the biggest problem of the 21st century, is mass movements of people across borders. And borders are always fraught with tension, yeah. And they're artificial. And we're going to have to learn how to deal with it. I'm not sure building walls is the way, but certainly to be more responsible about how we behave as first world countries. In other words, the weapons that are prosecuting these wars are built here. They're built in Europe. They're built in Russia. They're not built where the people are suffering. Mm. And I think we have to take responsibility for that. So any refugee story like that is something I would be attracted to. I think it's an important message to get across.
You said that they have carte blanche to use your recordings. And I'm sure we'll see this once we actually see it. Are there any new arrangements or maybe songs that we haven't heard? Or is it like, oh no, it's the familiar recordings, the studio recordings that we've heard?
It's actually me singing. With the new backing.
Really?
Yeah, they've used my voice.
So it's your original voice from the studio recordings?
No, actually, I recorded some of them.
Amazing.
Again, because...
Looking forward to the cast album of this one,
once the backing was recreated, I needed to respond to that.
Right, because it wouldn't work. Well, that's a treat.
But that's been my only contribution.
So far.
So far.
You never know. You could end up in the dance troupe.
Well, no, I'm going to make the announcement to turn your phone off at the beginning. But apart from that.
Oh, really?
No. And I won't end up in the dance troupe. That's a promise.
Moving on, you have your Vegas residency, your first Vegas residency, starting on May 22nd at the Coliseum at Caesar's Palace. A lot of folks have done residencies. I've seen a number of them in Vegas. Aside from the obvious, like, financial reward and you can be in one place at one time, why did this specific pitch at the Coliseum seem appealing to you to do?
You know, I've played Vegas many, many times over the years, coming in for one night to play, you know, various entertainment venues. This will be the first time I actually have my own room.
Yeah.
That's dedicated to me and telling my story through song. So... I won't be changing a gown every song.
Come on.
No.
Can we be wearing a gown at all?
I won't be even wearing headdresses. But there is an opportunity to make a more theatrical show than I normally would. I normally just rely on good lights, great band, and songs.
Right.
And this gives me the chance to explore
that
more
stage
theatrical
is huge,
areas.
By the way.
Yeah.
That's
and
enormous.
I love the room. I think Caesar's Palace is a great room. It's a big room, but it's also very intimate. It's the architecture is intimate. So it gives me a chance to get close to the audience, and they get close to me. And I'll be telling my story through songs. How did I end up here in Vegas?
Is it like stories between songs? Is that what you're hoping? Or
will be songs between stories.
Is it mostly a hits sort of
Sorry,
show?
There will be stories between songs. That's
yes.
Or maybe the other way around.
Or songs between stories, too.
Yeah.
Is it basically a hits kind of show?
Yeah.
Can I make a request?
Sure.
We'll be together?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. When are you coming?
Your people are in the room. I think we can make that happen.
I'll put you on the spot.
I was saying that because you haven't performed We'll Be Together in a proper, like a tour setting since 2004. You did it as a one-off, I think, last year.
I used to perform it with Annie Lennox when we toured together. I did it this year at the Rainforest show.
Yeah. The one with the Eurythmics, I believe.
Yeah.
Can you make them do an album together? You seem to have the power to get them to show up at places.
Could happen.
You can duet with Annie on a whole collaborations album. I'll sort of wrap this up with kind of a sort of a sad-ish question, I suppose. And also, there sounds like there's a party next door. So if the folks listening to the podcast,
yeah,
there's
we
clearly
aren't invited,
a party. We weren't invited. We're in a closet, and there's a party next door. That could be a lyric. We're in a closet, and there's a party. No?
Okay, if you want to be...
No?
Okay.
I don't know.
Coming out of the closet, maybe.
Sure. I've already done that. Okay,
I haven't yet.
Yet. So, we're breaking news, Sting. Okay, so lastly, we recently lost someone that, though you didn't quite work with, you consented to have your music used in his work, Juice WRLD. Your song, Shape of My Heart, was sampled in his song, Lucid mm-hmm. Dreams. And you were supportive of this. And you've even performed kind of a mashup of those two songs together on stage.
Yeah.
You know, there are artists that aren't necessarily receptive to seeing their work interpolated or sampled in others, especially in hip hop. But you have been open to that and encouraging of that in some ways. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Well, first of all, when I heard it, I recognized something very special in that interpolation. I thought it was a wonderful interpolation. And so, of course, I was supportive of it. I never met the man and was horrified when he died so unnecessarily and so tragically. I think he was a great, great talent, and we miss him. I'd love to have worked with him. But as a tribute, we sing his song as part of, you know, the original Shape of My Heart. Mm-hmm. I think they fit together beautifully.
Is there, and I'm not naming names of people, but there are certain other artists that have had, you know, kind of an amazing sort of breadth of work similar to yours, and they've been very vocal about, like, no, they cannot take my music. But, I mean, you performed with Diddy, you know, on the VMAs that year with I'll Be Missing You.
I just find it interesting when people take what you've done and then make something new. This is how music stays alive, you know. I still, you know, there are copyright issues, and, you know, the creator of copyright needs to be rewarded,
right,
you know, appropriately. But saying to someone, you can't work with my material, you know, all of us borrow from everybody. You know,
yeah.
Every songwriter ahead of me, I borrowed from, whether it was, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein or the Beatles or Mozart. You know, we steal from each other. But, you know, we need to get paid, but also we should be open to seeing what happens when someone else takes your idea and puts it somewhere else.
Well, thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you.
Folks, go see The Last Ship. Go see Sting in Vegas.
Please come.
If you happen to be in the UK, travel down to London. Cross your fingers, Sting might be coming out soon. thank you again, sir.
Thank you. In a parallel universe.
In a parallel universe, you never know.
Don't knock it. We'll be together tonight.
We'll be together. All right, thank you, Sting.
Is this his first time on the show?
Nope.
This is, how many times has he been on?
Third.
Whoa, that's awesome.
Returning guesting.
Love it. That's incredible.
I know, and thank
We're
you.
We're great at booking this podcast.
You're incredible too, Sting. We love you. And now it's time for the chart stat of the week. Let's make it all fun, all for love. All right, keeping up with the Sting theme and the Grammy theme. This week in 1994, Sting was riding high on the Hot 100 chart with his first number one single, outside of The Police, his previous band, with All For Love.
Shocked you didn't sing that.
All For Love.
I would have definitely put money on that.
The Grammy Award-nominated Power Ballad, which is a co-build collaboration with Bryan Adams and Rod Stewart, hit number one on the January 22nd, 1994 dated chart, and spent a total of 3 weeks at number one. Now, the song, which was written and recorded for the film The Three Musketeers, is Sting's only number one outside of his work as frontman for The Police, which topped the Hot 100 back in the 80s with Every Breath You Take. So, there you have it. This week, back in 1994, Sting, Bryan Adams, and Rod Stewart were all for one and number one on the Hot 100 chart.
There it is. Now it's all for one,
all for love. Okay, we've reached the end of our big shoe. Any parting words?
Oh, who's going to be our Grammy guest next year? Who's going to win Album of the Year in 2021?
Start your predictions now.
let us know.
tweet us. What song should we go out on?
Well, goodness. I don't know.
The Record of the Year winner, Bad Guy?
I think that's a great idea.
See you guys next time.
Bye. I'm the bad guy. Duh.